those of you who are joining us for the first time. I am to present myself and describe myself. I am Marion. I will be leading this third roundtable discussion. I am French nationality. I'm speaking from Paris. And I am a white woman, sighted woman of about 40 years with mid-length brown hair. I have a helmet. I have earphones, big black earphones, and a flower pattern blouse. Thank you to Céline who questioned me on this description part that we invited you to give before speaking up, each of you, each of us being, insofar as our conference is regarding critical studies regarding blindness. So it's welcome to criticize these little instructions. And I was listening to an exchange earlier on the importance of color or not, relevance of color, of verbalism. And as an amateur audio descriptor, I mention colors because, as Bertrand Véry knows himself, he who I understand does not understand situate himself in the nostalgia of light, isn't interested in colors, but we know that other non-seeing people are interested in color, even if they have never perceived them, nonetheless associate them with, like Helen Keller, associate them with other senses than sight. When I say when I call myself a white woman, I'm not white as in the sense of the color, like black people are not black. But this is a way of assigning social assignation and meaning to say from what viewpoint we are coming from. As for my flower pattern blouse, I hope that you can smell the perfume of the flowers, not just see the colors. So, blindness and existence, phenomenology and ecology. Vanessa is going to be leading us, and we are going to be talking to David Anderson, Dylan Sroussi, and Devon Healy. So now, over to Vanessa.
Thank you very much, Marion. So, hello, for those of you who are just joining us, my name is Vanessa Warren, and I will offer a colorful description of myself, only I offer a few colors. I am a woman in my late 40s who is white. I am wearing a boring black shirt, and I have black earrings. My hair is brown, and I sit in a room with a bookcase behind me. I join you from Treaty One territory, homeland of the Métis Nation, in what is also known as Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you all to Roundtable 3 of the Critical Blindness Studies Conference. Roundtable 3 is dedicated to blindness and being, geography, phenomenology, and ecology. And I think it would be fair to say that we have had already an extremely engaging and rewarding day. And I am grateful to you for joining, perhaps very late in the evening for you, or in midday to participate in this conversation. Today's events give me great excitement for what is to come in the 3 days that will follow. So we will hear, I am pleased to say, from three scholars in this session, and I will introduce them one by one and ask them to offer a brief statement of 5 minutes before turning to the next speaker. And we will look forward to a question and answer, or what I hope will be a conversation that will follow and which will be moderated by Marion. So I will begin with David R. Anderson. David is a PhD candidate in the Faculty of Environmental and Urban Change at York University, Toronto, Canada. His research argues for the eco-crip political possibilities of non-normative sense-making practices through the close reading of blindness and ecological memoirs. David's research engages disability studies, the environmental humanities, queer and feminist theories, and critical race and whiteness studies. And some of his recent work has been published in, among other forums, Feminist Formations and Disability Studies Quarterly. We welcome you, David. Please kindly describe yourself, and then you have the floor for 5 minutes.
Thank you very, very much, Vanessa. And thank you to you, Hannah, and everyone else involved for making the conference happen. I'm really happy to be here. You can hear me okay?
We hear you well. Thank you, David.
Okay, great. So yes, my name is David. I'm a PhD candidate at York University in Toronto, Canada, Canada otherwise known as Turtle Island, which is, and in Toronto specifically, is the traditional territory of the Huron-Wendat, the Seneca, and the Mississauga of the Credit. I am about 6 feet tall. I am burly. I'm a cis white man, 41, visually impaired. I have light brown hair, a trimmed beard, a mustache, and blue eyes. And I'm wearing a tank top and shorts because it's hot in Toronto. I know we're not supposed to start with apologies. It's generally not a good form, but I will submit this to the website, my remarks, because I haven't got to that yet, and I apologize to everyone. And just to say that McClear and Lanham are no longer part of this talk. They just didn't fit into the chapter. So my dissertation examines blindness through the close reading of memoirs for non-dominant sensoriums and moments of ecological relationality. My work incorporates blind, crip, feminist, queer, ecological, and Black studies perspectives. And I employ an analytic of correspondence to think about how we use analogy, generosity, and a sense of responsiveness in our attempts to communicate with one another, not only between humans, but also between humans and nature. I track correspondences of non-dominant sensoriums because they offer us different modes of knowledge-making, of valuing life and experience, of relationality, and hopefully a more just politics. Today, I'll just focus on one chapter, which for now is called Rearranging the Senses, in which I analyze the links between nature and blindness and ask two broad questions. First of all, what can blindness as teacher, to quote Rod Michalko, M-I-C-H-A-L-K-O, what can blindness as teacher help us understand about our ecological politics and our relationships to nature, specifically ecological intimacy, loss, mastery, and mutual vulnerability? In other words, what is a blind ecology and how do we embrace it? And two, what can blindness as student learn from nature about non-dominant sensoriums, alternate forms of knowledge making, and of kinship? In other words, what is an ecological blindness and how do we avoid it? These questions give me space to think about writing for, that is, the way in which animals, for instance, do not write books. However, nature still manages to write itself in, on, and through our lives. For instance, The Year Without a Summer in 1816, in which Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, is a good example. The eruption of Mount Tambora, T-A-M-B-O-R-A, and the eventual drop in global temperatures during the following summer set the stage for the ghostwriting competition, which, it must be said, Shelley handily won. Thus, nature, and our vulnerability to it, places its hand in all we write and indeed all we do. And yet we still find ourselves writing for those parts of nature, animals, plants, and other more and more vulnerable ecologies that are running out of time for us to sense their precarity. In this chapter, I respond to and build from Rod Michalko's work, The Two in One, Walking with Smokey, Walking with Blindness. And to egregiously oversimplify, Michalko argues two important things, that nature doesn't care about how we think about blindness and sight, or about how we think of nature and society. And that, too, we must be critical of our common sense understandings of blindness and nature. I follow these arguments because they invite us to sense how there are multiple forms of blindness, and that when we pay attention to these different blindnesses, as Michalko says, our connections to animal kinships, we begin to better notice how such intimacies can, as he says, quote unquote, rearrange our senses, both in how we can shift our way of using our senses to notice the natural world differently,
but also in how we can shift our political sensoriums about who counts or not in politics, who has a voice and who gets to speak, and who is speaking for who. So in one way, I think and I walk and I read carefully with Macalco and his guide dog Smokey as he relates to us his experience of going blind over and over again. Issues of loss, kinship, trust, mastery, and the relationships between blindness and nature are highlighted. I argue that in this book of his, we must return, what I want to argue is that the two-in-one is a book that we really need to return to in this moment of global climate catastrophe, of extinction and habitat loss. I worry that we have failed to bring his important insights to bear on our current moment. I also think Fly and closely read with Helen MacDonald, the author, and her goshawk Mabel in her memoir, H is for Hawk. MacDonald alerts us to the astounding differences in visual capacities between humans and hawks, and also how living with and during her mental breakdown as a hawk, she came to better understand what it means to be human, to live in nature with animals, and how to think differently about our relationships to nature, especially through a reconceptualization of what it means to recover, or the recovery memoir genre. In the face of loss of all kinds, loss of vision, loss of nature, loss of friends, I think we've all experienced many losses during COVID or noticed loss even more. Recovery must become something more radical, is my argument, attuned to our ecological blindnesses, so how we all are can be blind to nature and the natural world, and also to the many blindnesses which we have for too long neglected that might help us to see in a different way or otherwise. I'm very grateful for being here and for everyone's attention, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
We thank you, David. We turn now to Devin Healy. And Devin, before I introduce you, I'll just say it's very nice to be in this space sharing it with you. We met quite a few years ago in Toronto at the Canadian Disability Studies Association Conference, and this is our first opportunity to re-engage. So welcome, Devin. Devin Healy is an assistant professor of disability studies at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education at the University of Toronto. All of her work is grounded as a blind woman who is guided by a desire to show how blindness specifically and disability more broadly can be understood as offering an alternate form of perception and is thus a valuable and creative way of experiencing and knowing the world. I'm pleased to tell you that she is the author of a recently published book, Dramatizing Blindness, Disability Studies as Critical Creative Narrative. And I will also note in 2020, she was awarded a commission to both write and perform in Rainbow on Mars, a sensory reclamation of blindness. So welcome again, Devin. Please kindly describe yourself, and you have the floor for 5 minutes.
Hi, Devin speaking here. Thank you so much, Vanessa. It's a pleasure to be in your company again as well. Please excuse me if a cough or sneeze sneaks its way into my talk. I'm in the midst of recovering from COVID, as I'm sure many of you have experienced, but I do hope that there are some of you out there who have not. Given the hyper-visual dominance of Zoom, I'm not going to reproduce that dominance through a visual description of myself today. I'd like to thank Hannah, Vanessa, and Marion for organizing this conference and for inviting me here today. Thanks to David and Dylan and to all of you for joining us. My work explores the understanding that there is a distinction between blind and blindness. Blind is a life. Blindness is a culmination of the conceptions, understandings, and attitudes that exist in our culture regarding what it is to live blind. Living blind, then, is to live with blindness as culture. My research in the field of disability studies centers on sensory disabilities, particularly blindness. Conventionally, blindness is understood as simply the opposite of sight, of its lack. In contrast to this understanding, my work focuses on blindness as perception. This requires us, first of all, to assume that the world is not always as we see it. This is one of the key features and advantages of blind perception. It allows us to live that assumption. When you are blind, you don't see what others, what sighted others do. Blindness is not only a way of being in the world, it is also a way of perceiving it. But it is not merely perception, merely a different way of seeing the same world. Blind perception, then, is neither a different way of perceiving the world nor a new way. It is the act of not always accepting the world as it looks. In its most radical and critical sense, blind perception is an outright rejection of seeing the world only as it appears to sight. When sighted perception is understood as the only legitimate perception, and when what sight perceives is understood as the only thing to be seen, blindness becomes the critical moment for rejecting such ocular centrism. Ocular centrism, as blind scholar David Bolt suggests, produces a world that reproduces itself as the only possible one, and reproduces sight as the only possible pathway to such a world. Blindness represents a pathway quite distinct from, although connected to, that of sight, and of a pathway to a world equally as distinct. Now, how to express this perception, this pathway, this world in ways other than visual remains at the heart of my research. I approach disability, including my own blindness, as the dynamic life of performance. As such, disability studies allows us to socially locate instances of disability in the theater of everyday life. Social actors, disabled and non-disabled actors alike, participate in this theater to create multi-hyphen version images of disability. My work aims at unraveling this multi-hyphen image character of blindness in particular, and to reveal critical and creative ways of reimagining it. Imagining blindness as perception rather than distortion is one such example. I draw on the work of blind scholar and author, as David Anderson mentioned, Rod McKelko, as well as the work of the late great playwright and poet Lynn Manning, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, and Indigenous storyteller Thomas King, K-I-N-G. I make use of phenomenology together with various critical fields of inquiry such as Indigenous studies, Black studies, and queer studies as a way to develop a performative and theatrical sense of disability. My recent book, Dramatizing Blindness, Disability Studies as Critical Creative Narrative, thank you, Vanessa, for mentioning that, is one such example of how I do this. It's written as a play in five acts and follows the main character Aaron's journey into the beauty of blindness. After each act, there's a theoretical intermission that engages critically the drama of blindness in everyday life. As Vanessa also mentioned, I'm currently now in the workshopping stage of the play Rainbow on Mars, which is a sensory reclamation of blindness in the theater, both as performer, subject, and audience. And by subject, I mean the storytelling, the story of the play. All of my writing, teaching, and work incorporates theater and drama studies, narrative inquiry, and autoethnography too. And David, this is a shout out to you. We're using the same quote, and I love it. As Rod McKelko, M-I-C-H-A-L-K-O, writes, to understand blindness as teacher. And I think this is quite exciting that today we've all been engaging in both blindness as teacher and all of us as students. Thank you so much, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you very much, Devin. We appreciate that. And now we turn to our third speaker and welcome him. So I am pleased to say it is my great pleasure to welcome Dylan Cerossi. Dylan is a student in philosophy at the University of Paris 1, Pantheon Sorbonne. And he is now preparing, most excitingly, for examinations in philosophy. His Master 2 was co-directed by Jocelyn Benoit and my colleague here, Marion Chotin, and received the congratulations of the jury, for which we congratulate Dylan. His dissertation on blindness is at the crossroads of disability studies and phenomenology. It mobilizes authors such as Pierre Villet, John Hull, and Georgina Klieg, one of our plenaries, on the side of blindness. And then on the side of philosophers, we have, for example, Merleau-Ponty, Husserl, Michel Henry. We welcome you, Dylan. We would invite you to please kindly describe yourself if you choose, and then you have the floor for 5 minutes.
Bonjour, Vanessa. Merci beaucoup de m'avoir présenté.
Thank you very much for introducing me. First of all, I would like to say I was very enthusiastic by the presentations that were made, whether that was that of Devin or David presentation. I'm thinking about Romy Chalco, one of my preferred author, especially when dealing with blindness as a feature. And Devin, you mentioned blindness as being a critical point in time. It's one of my viewpoints. My name is Dylan Strussi. I'm a white man, a French citizen, working at the University Paris 1, black hair, Frieda's bird, subtle nose, and I shall present my work pertaining to blindness. As Vanessa said, it's at the crossroads of phenomenology and disabilities studies, but also dealing with cognitive studies. And in order to present briefly my work in 5 minutes, I would like to say that the main issue was the phenomenology. I understood to understand blindness not only as a pre-established social order, which I thought was pretty obvious, but my aim was to understand the life experience of the people, not only through social experiences, but by the private individual's experiences. So my research focused on the common suburbity, i.e. the experiences of sight and blindness. I wanted to understand blindness, have a positiveness of experience, and in the meantime, understand how do interact perception with blindness, so we can move out from a schema which would be characteristic of sight or of light, as it was previously explained in the previous session. So I had to move out from a phenomenology of light, looking at this commensurability, so how we could determine the experience before the experience, the possibility of the experience. So the first part of my work focused on this a priori experience, which led me to revisit the history of philosophy. I'm thinking about Diderot or Molinos' problem at Locke's, but also I'm thinking about the debate undertook by Descartes, looking at the status of the blind people, the cane of the blind people. And my aim was to then look back at the phenomenology with the transcendental aspect for those of you who are not used with transcendentality, that's the basis on which you can define a determination of the experience, the possibility of an experience. And that led me to study philosophers such as Derrida in his very nice book, Memories of a Blind Person. And he considers blindness as a perception, not as an interception, and to understand those modalities. And I would like to agree with what was said previously, the multi-senses approach is important. So I used the sense of touch as being the original sense that was used by mankind, and that study on the basis of that viewpoint, and then looked this under the angle of the cognitive studies, so as to understand blindness as in a multi-sense approach. I've also looked at a book called Telling the Non-Visual Aspects of Life. And this first part led me to a second part, which allowed me to study blindness, not distinguishing two humanities with different rhythm. And I looked at the Michalko book, 12, which is a book pretty exceptional, telling us about the blindness has the critical time with regard phenomenology, how you can reduce phenomenology, a time where vision is completely subtracted, so it has to leave the room to another positiveness, which allowed me to define blindness not as the difference of the sighted people, but has its origin then leading to the work of Hells and the methodological works made by him, considering the possibility of an invisible sphere. So that's what I did.
Thank you very much, Dylan.
Merci beaucoup, Dylan.
And thank you to all of our speakers.
Merci à tous nos orateurs.
I'm just having a technical issue. I'm hearing translation into French
traduction en français
versus English. So I think perhaps our translators are offering on the wrong line right now. Maybe it's taken care of. Thank you so much to our translators. And with great gratitude to our translators, I will invite all of us to speak perhaps more slowly than we normally would. I will find that very difficult. We all have so much to say, but especially at the end of this long day, if we may try to slow down, that would be very accommodating for all involved, especially at this time in the day, as noted. So thank you all very much. It is my great pleasure to respond to what you have offered in writing and otherwise. And I will just note for David, who offered an apology, we embrace work in progress and no apology is needed. We are here to think together. And so please know that that is very welcome. To be part of the evolution of your work is a great excitement for us all. I would like to just say a few words about some connections and then to address our important guiding questions. But I will just flag that I have a question for all of you regarding methodology, as I feel you've been very generous in discussing methodology. And I see an important connection to memoir, which is a topic we have already engaged in a previous session today. So I will return to that. But I will just note that we have been hearing from three scholars who offers their thoughts on ways we might map spatially through phenomenology or relationally experiences of blindness. And I think you will probably agree with me as audience members that we can sense their work is connected by a shared interest in the genre and the capacity of memoir, of its importance to lived experiences of blindness, and also their interest in self-representation and creative or varied routes of self-representation. And also, I think very importantly, by relationships between people, between people and non-human animals, and between people and their environment, including their perceived environment. This, of course, includes natural spaces. I am struck that all three of you are referencing the work of Rod Machalco today, which is very exciting. I am proud to be Canadian at this moment. Interestingly, a strong presence from Canadian scholarship here. But we also sense the importance of work by John Hull to work that you are sharing with us. Also, Hull spelled H-U-L-L. I'm grateful for what you've shared, but I would like to begin, if I might, with this question of memoir, whether it is memoir as object of study, in perhaps your case, Dylan, most obviously, Devin, perhaps memoir as method, and perhaps I might invite us to think about what Selena Mills so generously shared earlier today regarding the way in which memoir has shaped and perhaps energized her engagement with the history of blindness. This seems to me a theme coming out of our conversation today. David, may I begin with you, because memoir has featured for you as an object of study, and then perhaps we could go in order to Devin and then to Dylan. David?
Thank you very much again. What a generous question. And I apologize to the translators. I so appreciate the work you've done, and I apologize for speaking so fast. It's a great question. You know, Helen Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R, in The World I Live in the preface, says something along the lines of, all writing at one point or another is autobiographical. And yet she faces this accusation around, you know, either all we want to hear is about you, and then conversely, because all you can write, if you can write, we're not sure, is about you, you probably don't really have that much to say that we need to know. And I love that book because of the way that she is making a response to these accusations. And when I have been approaching memoir as an object, and kind of also as a method, partially too, like I think I take her seriously that we're always autobiographically part of the writing, whether or not we're using a genre that distances ourselves from, appears to distance ourselves from the text. So for sure as an object, and for me, it's about a bit of a definition too, not kind of one that I made for myself, is that I tried to select texts that maybe do track a life, or in like say Helen MacDonald's H is for Hawk, it's a year when her father dies, the loss and the depression that brings on, the madness and lunacy she talks about that it brings on, or something larger. But for me, memoir is always about bringing the world in, bringing consequence in, bringing the reality of the material world into highlight it in order to show how one individual life is connected to many others. And in this chapter, I'm working on with the work of Machalco and MacDonald. Again, it's because animals do not write. And we talked in presenters spoke and answered questions in the last couple of sessions about writing, about definitions of blindness. And for me, it was, you know, the blind, I think, share in a sense of being written for, like animals. And so, you know, animals can't write their memoirs, I guess is what I'm saying. So, I think it's a fascinating mode of choosing objects. I also think it's very helpful as a method, Devin's work in terms of performance, right? And Dylan's analysis of Hull and looking at, you know, Derrida, Memoirs of the Blind, different depictions of painters painting themselves. So I think it's a fascinating one. I always worry that, you know, certain memoirs aren't always equal to others. They cleave more to autobiography, a sort of unending laundry list of their day-to-day minutiae, but not really connecting to the outside world. So for me, it was, I'm a literary studies scholar, but I'm very concerned about the material consequences, say, of, you know, the global climate crisis, for instance, racialized violence that has caused a spike in instances of blindness in racialized communities. So memoir to me was a good place to go as a balance between literature of all kinds, which I love, poetry, fiction, everything, and, you know, the politics of our day-to-day worlds. I hope I'm answering that. Sorry, that question.
Yes, and thank you, David. And actually, you give us a very nice bridge to Devin, because Devin, in the work that you shared prior to our gathering today, you use poetry as well as memoir to enrich and again to make your engagement with blindness and lived experiences both deeply personal and powerfully theorized. Devin, could we turn to you now?
Hi, Vanessa. Thanks so much. Devin speaking here. I'm reminded of the words of Thomas King, K-I-N-G, where he says in his book, The Truth About Stories, and he says, quote, "The truth about stories is that that's all we are," end quote. And I can't shake that quote. No matter how many times I think I've got it down, okay, I figured that out, the truth about stories, it comes back to me. It comes back to me when I think about my life as a blind woman and my life in blindness and the interactions that I have with people. When we think about memoir and experience, and in particular, lived experience comes up, I don't experience my blindness alone. We're never alone in our bodies. My blindness comes alive in the midst of others, in interactions with all of you here today, with sighted people, and I'm gesturing to a window beside me on the street, as well as blind people on the street. So what I find intriguing about memoir is that it's a snapshot of the culture within which we live and exist. And to enter into theorizing blindness, to pause in these moments, these snapshots, these stories of blindness, and to listen to our culture and to think, okay, what is happening in this moment? How is my blindness coming alive? How is it being interpreted? How am I living blind and blindness? And so in my writing, I draw on experiences not to suggest any sort of expertise in blindness, because I don't think that being blind provides that sense of expertise. In fact, I really question the notion of expert to begin with, but rather as a way to enter, or perhaps to raise the curtain on this many stages of everyday life where blindness does make an appearance, and to theorize that. And I feel when I'm talking about it, the excitement to me when we bring in memoir or performance, blindness comes alive in ways that I don't think I experienced in those moments of interaction. And so that's a bit of a methodological twist, Vanessa. I hope I'm answering your question that I use. And of course, I'm following many blind scholars who have come before me, and I hope to add a little speck of my own blindness and my own sense of theorization to that. So I'm so grateful to have spent the day with all of you, and now Dylan and David, to hear you both. Because as King says, the truth about stories is that that's all we are. And now together, we're a part of each other's. Thanks so much, Vanessa.
Thank you very much, Devin. And Dylan, as we turn to you on this question of memoir, I will go slowly for our translators here. I am thinking about the way in which the work of some contemporary authors, memoirists, like Georgina Klieg, who joins us as a plenary at this event, their memoir work is almost like it is a response, but a correction, a corrective to some of the work, especially of the 18th century French philosophers and their, you know, hypothetical, again, I draw on Georgina Klieg here, their hypothetical conceptions of blindness. So Dylan, I am very interested in and excited about your work, for you put into conversation the memoirist and the philosopher. When, of course, those things, as we are being reminded, also overlap and do not have a clear barrier between them. Dylan, would you like to speak to this subject of your object of study, the memoir?
Oui, oui, bien sûr.
Yes, of course. So, memoir at Georgina Klieg's work. I will try to speak more slowly to try to understand the critics made, the correction she brought with regards by what was said by the philosophers of the 17th century. She was angry against Descartes, who hypothesized the blind person who would use just a cane. Another sighted person. So a memoir of the blind person, the way she is staging herself in an autobiography is very interesting because she is considering the way she is watching movies with the very little sight she still has. So she is considering the different pictures she has had in her life, and she is trying to build her own identity as a blind person. And then the issue of memory is related to a past, the past of a person who was sometimes a sighted person, sometimes a blind person. But in Georgina Klieg's work, this issue exists, but this issue is even more important in the autobiography of John Hell. This is a time where John Hell is talking a lot about his visual past. So we can distinguish an early or blindness or a late blindness, such as that of John Hell, who is haunted by his visual past, and the issue of the memoir here is very ambiguous, leading to more problems, because one may wonder why this memoir is still a reality for John Hull. This visual memory is still haunting him. And then this dialectic is much more complex than, and there is, from the phenomenology point of view, there's still something in his memoir which does not allow him to be positive as regards his blindness. And I think the issue of memoir is more than essential, it is instrumental. We can see that because memory is not only that of our past, but it is also memoir of our body, John Hull's experiences on a daily basis, the memory of his body.
Qui finalement est une mémoire corporelle qui le ramène en quelque sorte, qui le fait appartenir à celui-ci. Donc voilà, je l'aborderai de cette
manière. That helps him to belong. That is the way that I will approach the subject.
Thank you very much. This is very useful. I have a responsibility now to be sure to engage with some of our subjects, our guiding questions very directly. And if I might, I would like to begin with the question of disability studies. We have an interesting situation. Perhaps I can start with you, Devin, as you now have your academic home in disability studies. And for you, blindness studies studies seems to be part of a larger kind of umbrella, could we say, idea of disability studies. But one of the challenges we seem to encounter is the diversity of experiences of disability. And one of the questions many people will raise is, what does the lived experience of blindness perhaps have to do with, say, a lived experience of intellectual difference or a lived experience of mobility limitation? And so, Devin, may I start with you? And I should say, think of this perhaps as a lightning round, as fast, but to think about a comment from you first, Devin, on disability studies and or blindness studies. Thank you.
Hi, thanks, Vanessa. I think what is dynamic about disability studies is that it does not thingify disability as an object to be studied, but rather turns that gaze that typically medicine has taken up to focus and question and solve and define the quote problem of disability. We turn that gaze to normalcy and question how it is this sense of normal is constructed. And I think that in particular, and I love that, Vanessa, the umbrella term of blind studies, what all of us can offer is that sense of perception, of perceiving the ways in which we come together, the ways in which we know. Our perceptions can offer a different sense of what it means to be human and of how does we come together. That's my quick lightning rod answer. Thank you.
We appreciate that, Devin. David, I will turn to you next, if I could, because you work at the intersections also, of course, of animal studies and of ecology studies. And so perhaps you have a perspective you would like to share about that idea of how blindness studies may relate to, differ from, belong as part of disability studies. So to you, David.
Disability studies for me is something that just needs to be additive. I feel like a lot of what we find in disabilities is the outcome or consequence, not all the time, but of other, you know, colonial, capitalist, neoliberal issues that then can create situations where either we become disabled or debilitated, or we encounter disability in terms of the physical environment, the social environment. So that's why I use EcoCRIP theory, which is sort of a new burgeoning area of study, ECO-CRIP, EcoCRIP theory. But I'm also really indebted to Black disability studies. And of course, you know, as I mentioned earlier, CRIP, queer and feminist disability studies, disability studies and then thus the project of blind studies, if it's not really fundamentally engaged with these areas, it really loses out. When I teach with students, I often say, you know, blindness studies, they're like, is that a thing? Is it? And I always make it an acronym of BS, which, as we know, pardon my language, but, you know, could be bullshit, right? So how to make it not bullshit to me is about, you know, the things that Devin mentioned, Dylan's attention to memoir and what it is capable of or not, and how we read. To me, disability studies and blindness studies need to be in conversation with these often oppressive forces, but also the work that's being done both academically, in an activist way, and artistically to combat, resist, and reimagine them. That, I think, would be my response to that, just briefly.
Thank you very much, David. I think, I'm not sure how this will translate into French, but you remind us of the dangers of the silo, yes? And not only the silo between perhaps disciplines, but also the silo between creative work and academic work. And also, importantly and pressingly, I hope we will get to this in the discussion, social justice work, which is, of course, important at the core of disability studies, but also of the work you have been doing in terms of ecological work. Dylan, can we turn to you now? Do you feel at home in disability studies? Is blindness studies something you seek to define? Over to you, Dylan.
Disability
studies, above all, have been used in my work as a springboard and a social analysis of blindness and its social construction. It's at that level that I use disability studies. Also in the manner in which disability studies have shown the fact that experience cannot be reduced to an overall group of sensations, but that blindness is a witness and an actor. And that's what I'm trying to develop in terms of the way that the social field itself is an experience that is really phenomenologically experienced. And it's at the crossroads of those two fields of study that I was able to bring together the link between lived experience as it is lived by blind people on a daily basis, and at the same time, society that is mostly not adapted to non-seeing people. So that's how I've been using disability studies, despite some of the voices that we hear, and I've been talking with Marion yesterday. The neo-materialistic approach of Snyder and Mitchell leaves me a little bit uncertain, less convinced than others as to the question of differences.
And Dylan references there Sharon Snyder and David Mitchell's work, perhaps most famously synthesized in narrative prosthesis. You have all been so succinct and generous. I will turn to Marion, my colleague, in just 2 minutes, Marion. If our public, our audience could begin to raise hands to share questions or comments, that would be great. But even now, a quicker lightning round, perhaps. What, may I ask, is the one thing you would like to see included in a definition or a mapping out of blindness studies? This is a tough question, and we have days to come to resolve it or to develop it. But is there one pressing thing that strikes you on this evening, on this afternoon, that you would like to see incorporated in the definition of this field? Should that be the direction we go in as a community? I will, to shake things up, if it's okay, I will reverse order. And Dylan, take a moment to think before we move on to the discussion period. But Dylan, is there something you think is for you urgent for inclusion in this definition?
I will confess I have never thought deeply about that, but you're talking about definition of blindness studies in general, what they should involve in terms of discussion and dialogue. The discussion, main one, would be to know to what extent it must continue using sighted people's categories. One of the problems, obvious problems, to what extent can we continue to use a sighted vocabulary, to continue studying this field? Should we build blindness studies around the duality of sighted and non-sighted, or should we go in the opposite direction and talk about the positivity of blindness in all its field of experiences? It's a very difficult dialogue, a very difficult issue, and maybe impossible to solve, but we need to talk about the risk, and that's something I'm interested in my research.
Thank you very much, Dylan, and that has wonderful connections to our first roundtable today, I think, and also, of course, to our wonderful plenary at First Thing this morning from Korean. May I go to you now, David?
thank you. So this is the question about the definitions that we use, correct?
This is a question, perhaps it is a difficult one, but I'm trying to ask what you would like to have included. Should blindness studies be defined as a field? What would you want? What is your thing you could not be without?
I see. Sorry. Thank you. I love that. I mean, I really am interested just to riff on Dylan, to add to that, the sense of the sighted vocabulary. I'd be interested to think about, yeah, what could blindness studies and definitions of blindness do to complicate that? I guess for me, I've been thinking today a lot about what Bertrand mentioned about polysensuality. For me, it's like Klieg writes in Sight Unseen, Kleege, about how, you know, it's not that the blind have heightened senses, it's just that we use them differently. And, you know, the world is full of things to sense and feel and perceive. It's just about whether or not we pay attention to them. You know, since moving to Toronto, I've often found that, and also, like, I'm 41 years old, I'm a man, and my hearing is starting to go. And the less I can hear, you know, the blinder I feel, the more blind that I am changing my relationship to that. And so for me, I think any blindness studies that we use to me has to be both intersectional in terms of what are the larger formations, especially oppressive formations that are shaping all of us all the time, but also the beauty and the opportunity and the risk, as Dylan also said, I like that word a lot, of, you know, the multi-poly sensuousness available to us, the way that we are all sensing each other. We might not ever be able to share those perfectly. My sense of correspondence that I borrow from Helen Keller is really about there's always a limit. You know, that's why she says there are not deafblind terms to, there are not deafblind metaphors in the general parlance, in general vocabulary for us to use. And that's why she says, I'm turning to sight metaphors to so that you, the sighted world, can understand. But I think there's a great opportunity, as risky as it might be, to like really insist on that polysensuousness and that we all come to blindness differently, that it has to be these blindnesses that Macalco talks about. So I hope that answers the question. It's a good one. It's a tough one.
It is. Thank you, David. And thank you for your generosity in answering it. And I hope we will return to this question of metaphor, which matters so much to conversations about blindness in Western culture in the contemporary moment, as it has for several centuries. Devin, to you, perhaps for thought before we hand over to Marion for the discussion period.
Thanks. Devin speaking here. Vanessa, I think my hope for the definition of blindness studies is that we never reach one. I think that engaging with the mystery and the beauty of blindness and not pinning that down is quite honestly, I think, the power of blind perception. I know for myself that as soon as I think that I have blindness figured out, that I can do this, quote, blind thing, it changes from day to day. And so I'm constantly being introduced to blindness, to myself as blind. And so my blindness is always a work in progress, and I can never quite pin it down. And I hope that together and all of us in blind studies work to resist the pinning down of blind studies, but always to respond and to address the questions that, you know, definitions often raise. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much for that. Very provocative and important. So I will just, in case I do not have a chance, thank you all for this opportunity to be in conversation with you. I've enjoyed it very much. And now over to you, Marion.
Merci beaucoup, Vanessa. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you to all of the participants for what you've had to say. Philosophical, very convergent. Before I hand over to our friend Flavio, who puts his hand up, I want to point out that what is obvious from what you have said is that the multiplicity of not just of sensualities, but also the multiplicities themselves of blindness itself, so far from the construction of its definition as a deficiency of sight that Corinne Doria showed us this morning. I think you share, all three of you, an apprehension in the sense of a concept, a non-monolithic concept, a mobile and fluctuating concept of blindness. You've said it, Devon and Dylan, too, all three of you, I believe. Approach of blindness as a mode of perception, alternative mode of perception, and you have a joint, an intersection between all three of you. We talked to Anchalco and John Hull, and those, I think, of those pages that Dylan commented in his work of the rain falling that is representative of what you've said, insofar as the people who see the rain fall on the world, whereas John Hull shows us how the rain falling makes the world as far as he's concerned. And I think it's an example of this same experience of rhythm. You both use the term, something that is philosophically based, that is experiential, as well as being present in the texts, the literature that we have seen earlier today. Thank you so much to all three of you. I'm handing over now to Flavio, and then there will be a question from Marion Inc and David Johnson. Let's listen to Flavio now. If you aren't ready, maybe Marion, could you ask your question, and we'll come back to Flavio later, in a second time, later on. It's a question to all three of you, but probably more to Dylan. I will talk about it more during the round table on Tuesday. I want to show how perception goes beyond understanding of sensuality. As long as we stay with the sensory perception of reality, there will always be ocular centricism. Sound is very bad. I'm very sorry. I have terrible difficulty understanding the words. Is this dimension something that you have already studied in terms of perception? Furthermore, it has been said in the works in philosophy and phenomenology, except that I feel that even phenomenologists who are persuaded of a practical and sensitive approach to perception, in concrete terms, we are coming back to an extremely centered on senses, conceiving perception as a phenomenon of the senses.
Dylan, est-ce que vous pouvez...
Dylan, can you answer Marion? Concerning this concept of perception based on sensuality, on senses, and the vision... I will answer in various pieces. I am in agreement with the issue. I do not know the practical sensitive concept. but that perception is a practice that is an education, a construct of life. That seems obvious in phenomenology. It's already been defended by contemporary writers. But I do feel, on the other hand, that what when you criticize phenomenologists...
Mais en fait, la question de la perception, ce n'est pas posée en termes véritablement de sensorialité dans la phénoménologie. Elle a commencé par la question de la connaissance, la perception comme connaissance, ça c'est surtout à CERN. Et après Merleau-Ponty, on passe plus vers la sensorialité, mais chez Merleau-Ponty, par exemple, je prends un phénoménologue comme vous n'en avez pas cité, j'en prends un par exemple, chez Merleau-Ponty, la perception ne se réduit pas à la sensorialité, par contre, elle la comprend dedans. C'est-à-dire que la perception agit, la perception est agissante, elle transforme le monde, elle le forme, elle le déforme même parfois. Mais par contre, elle n'est jamais véritablement réduite à la sensorialité. Par contre, je serais d'accord pour dire, comme vous, que dès lors qu'il faut appliquer de manière pratique la perception, il faut plus aller vers des auteurs déconstructeurs, parfois qui ne sont pas véritablement de tradition phénoménologique, pour le comprendre, notamment dans la tradition analytique, quelqu'un comme Austin comprend par exemple aussi bien plus la perception comme pratique. Mais dès lors, il faut séparer, à mon avis, deux zones. Et dès lors, je pense qu'il faut séparer deux zones, la perception comme origine, c'est-à-dire la perception et d'où elle vient et comment elle se produit, et après, la perception au quotidien. Et dès lors, on peut aller vers votre analyse de... qui sort de la sensorialité. Mais je ne pense pas exactement qu'on pourra sortir de la sensorialité. On la dépasse, oui, mais je pense qu'elle restera une des dimensions. Mais du coup, ça rejoint la pratique. Voilà si je peux répondre.
Bien, merci beaucoup, Dylan. Est-ce que, Flavio, vous avez résolu votre petite difficulté de micro? Est-ce que vous pouvez vous exprimer, s'il vous plaît?
Bonsoir, est-ce que vous m'entendez?
Pas très bien.
Ah, grâce à Dieu. Un moment, s'il vous plaît. Merci. Avant tout, je veux remercier cet spectaculaire table ronde qui me fait beaucoup mais amène beaucoup de choses à la tête. Je viens à ces colloques avec une question à la tête, c'est-à-dire qui veut dire je vais essayer de poser une question, mais je ne sais pas si c'est proprement une question ou c'est seulement une provocation. Mais il y a très peu de temps, j'ai commencé à m'intéresser sur le réalisme spéculatif. Le réalisme spéculatif et l'ontologie orientée aux objets. Et j'ai commencé à m'intéresser par des concepts comme par exemple des hyper-objets créés par le philosophe Timothy Morton. Donc ma question ou seulement mon provocation pour vous, c'est est-ce que vous pensez que c'est possible de penser la cécité par rapport à la question de réalisme spéculatif et de pour être un peu plus clair? Je ne sais pas si tout le monde a de quoi il s'agit, le concept des hyperobjets. Par exemple, les hyperobjets, ce sont les objets qui existent dans le temps et dans l'espace, comme par exemple le trou noir ou le réchauffement global. Ce sont des choses qui préexistent et continuent à exister au-delà de l'existence humaine ou l'existence personnelle. Bon, je ne vais pas continuer, mais c'est tout seulement. Est-ce que vous pensez que c'est possible d'étudier la cécité par rapport à ce domaine? Merci.
Je ne sais pas qui souhaite répondre à Flavio. Au sujet de ce concept, notamment d'hyper-objet, Divonne, c'est à vous.
Hi, Devin speaking here. Flavio, thank you for your question. You're introducing me as well to a new field of study. So I've taken note of a few of your comments, and I will look into them. So forgive me if this is not a full answer. But I think that it does tie into a little bit with Marion's question earlier and Dylan, your answer in terms of phenomenology. And I'm thinking here of the senses in that eyes don't see, people do. And so we interpret a world and make sense of it as A, there to be seen, and B, to be in and of that production of the world. And so when you mention black holes or these hyper objects, Flavio, please correct me if I'm not getting that correct. But when you mention hyper objects such as black holes, sure, they're quote there, but we interpret their there-ness as a black hole, and we endow that black hole with meaning, and we research that, and we make sense of that together. So in terms of your question, can we do this with blindness? I think we're doing it now. I think that by merely asking these questions, we are engaging in that process of thinking how it is we come to say what we say and do what we do in relation to blindness, in relation to the world and our, to quote Hull, I think he talks about Jonathan Hull, H-U-L-L. For those of you out there who are more familiar with his work, jump in, and if I got this wrong, tell me. But I believe he speaks of blindness as world-building. And so I think we're engaging with that right now. And so, yes, I think that we can interact and engage and think of the senses as not static, but as something that we endow with meaning. We create that meaning, we enact that meaning, we perform that meaning. And I do think, Dylan, I so enjoyed your answer earlier. So I'm really thinking alongside you right now. And if you've got something that you want to add, Dylan or David, not to put either of you on the spot, but please do jump in. But I do think we endow that meaning, and we're engaging in that process right now. Thank you so much, Flavio.
Merci beaucoup, Divonne. Étant donné qu'il y a encore deux petites mains virtuelles de lever, je vais peut-être plutôt donner la parole à présent à David Johnson, s'il vous plaît. Et ensuite à Céline Roussel. Si ce n'est pas immédiat, j'en profite, Divonne, pour vous dire à quel point j'ai adoré votre poème, vos analyses, et particulièrement le passage au sujet des gens qui disent parfois, croyant bien dire et bien faire, j'ai oublié que vous étiez aveugle. Et vous vous écrivez, quand vous oubliez que je suis aveugle, vous m'oubliez et je pars. Et j'ai trouvé ça tellement beau et tellement juste. Et on entend souvent dire, moi, je fais abstraction de son handicap, cette fameuse expression. Et c'est tellement tout l'inverse qu'il faut faire, selon moi, sans essentialiser la personne. Je pense que vos mots et votre poésie aideront à faire comprendre cela aux personnes. J'ai vraiment été frappée par votre poème et votre texte, Devon. Alors, est-ce que David Johnson peut s'exprimer à présent en ouvrant son micro? Bien, peut-être que je vais alors passer la parole à Céline. Pardon? Oui, Céline, tu peux t'exprimer et nous verrons ensuite pour David. Merci.
D'accord, très bien, merci beaucoup. Donc je laisse le soin à Marion de vélotyper parce que je suis aussi à la vélotypie, mais elle va prendre le relais. Merci beaucoup, je trouve ça absolument passionnant. Et si ce n'est pas trop vous demander encore Dylan, vous qui avez beaucoup donné pendant cette session et qui avez dit des choses vraiment très très percutantes sur John Hull, que j'ai trouvé très très juste, j'aimerais vous poser une question puisque c'est aussi une autobiographie que j'étudie, mais moi-même d'un point de vue littéraire. Il y a beaucoup beaucoup de choses dans ce texte. C'est aussi un texte théologique, une vraie théologie chez John Hull qui n'est pas toujours facile de démêler. Moi-même, je ne suis pas philosophe, donc j'ai parfois un peu du mal à comprendre les contours de la philosophie de la cécité qu'esquisse John Hull. Est-ce que vous auriez la gentillesse peut-être d'indiquer quelles seraient selon vous les caractéristiques de cette philosophie de la cécité, une ou deux idées ou quelques grandes caractéristiques?
Je ne saurais pas où commencer. C'est un ouvrage tellement riche, c'est certainement un des plus riches que j'ai lu sur la cécité. Je pense que, bon, évidemment, comme vous l'avez dit, Céline, il y a une théologie. Cette théologie, elle est incroyable parce qu'elle vient contre les lignes. Elle vient de temps à autre, au détour d'un paragraphe, au détour d'une citation de l'Évangile. Donc, je pense qu'une des voies qu'il faudrait explorer, c'est, à mon avis, mais c'est parce que c'est mon domaine que je parle comme ça, à mon avis, mais c'est la croisée de la phénoménologie et de la théologie chez John Hull. Il y a quelque chose de phénoméno-théologique, notamment quand il parle de la lumière et de la nuit. C'est pas pour rien si, dans la traduction française, c'était « Touching the Rock », le titre, mais en français, ce qu'ils ne savent pas, c'est « Vers la nuit ». Bon, ce qui renvoie d'une certaine manière à un cliché, qui est le cliché de la nuit des aveugles, mais qui en même temps dit beaucoup de choses de ce qui arrive à John Hull au moment où il devient aveugle, c'est-à-dire j'ai envie de citer une phrase d'un phénoménologue qui s'appelle Eugène Minkowski, qui dit « c'est la face du monde qui change ». Et c'est vrai, pour le coup, et donc moi j'ai exploré, pour vous donner quelques voies, la question de l'appartenance du monde, donc la notion de monde chez John Hull, la notion de théologie à la croisée de la phénoménologie, et peut-être tous ces moments aussi que décrit John Hull de manière assez fine, ces moments sociaux où il se retrouve dans des moments avec beaucoup d'ironie, avec des gens qui lui parlent, il est obligé de se tourner vers eux, il explique un peu tous ces phénomènes. Et sinon, j'ai étudié aussi un peu le corps chez lui. Pas énormément, mais quand même. Je pense que c'est une voie de sa philosophie. Il le sent bien. Il dit de manière un peu oculocentrée, mais il dit avoir un corps, c'est voir de tout son... être aveugle, c'est voir de tout son corps. Donc, peut-être qu'il y aurait là une piste là-dessus. Voilà, mais il y aurait tellement de choses à dire, mais si vous voulez, on pourra en reparler. Mais voilà, c'est d'une manière brève, je dirais ça.
Oui, merci beaucoup. C'est très, très intéressant comme piste, en tout cas. Merci.
Merci beaucoup à tous les deux. Est-ce qu'à présent, David Johnson, vous pouvez vous exprimer? S'il n'y a pas d'autres petites mains levées, j'en profite pour revenir sur l'expression de la cécité comme enseignant de la nature. Et David Anderson, vous avez aussi mobilisé Rod Michalko à ce sujet et vous proposez aussi l'idée de cécité comme élève de la nature. Donc, pourriez-vous revenir sur ces idées et finalement nous dire ce que peut-être aussi la vue a à apprendre peut-être de la société via la nature, voilà, étant donné que, comme vous le soulignez, il n'y a que dans le monde des hommes que la cécité est conçue comme perte, manque et privation. Merci. Est-ce que...
Yes, oui, sorry merci. To interrupt there for a moment. Thank you for the very generous question. I was thinking when Flavio asked about the hyper objects, all I could think of was the scholar von Wexkull, von and then UEXKULL, who talks about this idea that, say, you can have a meadow and there are bees in the meadow, there are flowers in the meadow, there are deer, people, trees, a breeze. All kinds of things. To me, you don't need a black hole to have what we might call, what Morton might call a hyper object, because everything in that meadow experiences the meadow differently. And we can't really separate our senses from perception or our bodies. They are all one. Dylan was saying some really great things about how perception is practiced in education. And I agree with that. And so in my work with, say, Helen McDonald's H's for Hawk, what I really appreciate about her engagement, she's a very experienced falconer. She takes on a very difficult hawk to train, that is a goshawk, during a very difficult time in her life. And one of the moments that really jumps off the page is when she talks about how hawk's eyes, if we had hawk eyes as big as hawks, our eyeballs would be like huge oranges sticking out of our head. They can see into the ultraviolet spectrum. They can see polarized light. So they can actually see hot and cold bands of air. They can detect the magnetic field of the earth. And they can also see at great distances. In comparison, humans talking about sight and blindness is kind of a joke. So for me, when blindness is a student to, say, ecology, and it, like as you asked such a great question, this is sort of some of the things I think about, is that human senses, we're having this conversation about sight and blindness, which I think I'm so excited about. I'm so grateful to be here. As many people have said, it's so nice to be with others who take these ideas seriously and really want to wrestle with them in generous ways. I also think if we don't learn to give much more presence, and I think Dylan mentioned something about spirituality or theology along with Hull, and I know Devin's work, like the idea of rhythm, and also I know she has a character in one of her pieces that's sort of an imagined character. I guess there's something to me important around nature, not as a place that we simply go for education and then leave it behind, but that we take it with us and we give back and we form an ethical relationship to. And I think that's something that we can do through our noticing of how different our sensoriums are to other creatures, to one another. Maybe have more of a sense of spirit. You know, many Indigenous scholars, Devin mentioned Thomas King. I recently taught Eden Robinson's Trickster Trilogy. Robinson is Robinson. There's this way in which Indigenous scholars and writers give equal, if not more, weight to, say, the agency, the power, the active quality of different elements of nature, even stone. And I think that in a Western tradition of blindness, because of the Enlightenment, that's not something we do. And I'm not trying at all to reappropriate or just to appropriate period Indigenous knowledge, but just to point out that there are different ways of sensing in nature. And again, to come back to Macalco, he talks about rather than living with blindness as something we sort of begrudgingly put up with, or living with nature and this binary we set up about mastery and subordination, what if we lived in blindness? And I think Devin articulated that really beautifully today. What if we lived in nature, not just with it? So I'm not sure if I'm completely answering your question, but to me, and again, with the idea of the recovery memoir, Helen McDonald goes to nature, she raises a goshawk, she makes mistakes along the way, but she never, once she recovers in the way that she can, She doesn't just abandon nature and walk away. It's something that remains a part of her, and she learns better about what are the limits of being human, but that's also what makes living a beautiful thing. I was going to say one last point, just that in terms of blindness for me, I also think we need to include sighted folks and sighted writers. I would call it seeing otherwise. There's a way that even though we may always have to fight with ocular centrism, I think an earlier question was about this point, if we focus too much on the sensorium, we can't escape it, but there are different ways of using our eyes. There are different ways of, as Dylan quoted Hull, that blindness is seen with one's whole body. We can't just erase language, but there are different ways we could use it. I hope I have answered your really great question, Marianne.
Oui, oui, tout à fait, David, et je suis assez convaincue pour ma part du lien entre l'oculocentrisme et une certaine conception de la nature comme réduite à une simple réserve, un simple matériau à utiliser. Et dans l'histoire, ces deux moments sont relativement liés. Donc, pour ma part, je serais très favorable à inscrire dans notre manifeste la perspective de l'éco-théorie que vous développez. Merci beaucoup. Donc, je crois que maintenant, nous pouvons écouter David Johnson. David, est-ce que vous arrivez à présent à ouvrir votre micro? Puisque je crois que vous m'avez écrit que vous le pouviez désormais. Non, il y a toujours un souci technique. Quel dommage. Est-ce que vous avez pu sinon écrire dans le Google Doc? Non, je ne vois pas de questions non plus dans le Google Doc. Dans ce cas, je suis vraiment désolée et je vais passer la parole à Anna.
Thanks.
I ask a question to Dylan and Devin.
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. I'm gonna lower my hand because my question can wait till tomorrow.
If we're out of time, it's okay.
I think it's okay, David Anderson, for you to ask a quick question.
This is Vanessa stepping in. Perhaps we have technical difficulties. We opened the floor to David Johnson, who has technical difficulties, and then to David Anderson. David Anderson, did you want to briefly ask your question in our remaining minutes?
Yeah, if I may. Thank you. And thank you both to Dylan and Devin. Really nice to present. And the 3Ds, I was like, that must be magic. My question is actually about magic. Dylan, I noticed in your written piece submitted to the website, you mentioned something about a blind seer, like that image of the blind person who can be kind of a prophet, whatever. But I felt like you were doing something reparative with that, and I was so curious to hear more. And similar question to Devin, just, you know, is there some, like, we get trapped in this thing about being, you know, the super crip or having some sort of magical insight, but to be used by the sighted or as a burden. But is this a wrong question to even ask? Is there something about, you know, that there could be something magic about blindness that is outside of these binaries in terms of just the experience? I'm not trying to be flippant or, I don't know. I'm not trying to, anyway. I apologize. That's my question. Just could we reappropriate the blind seer, the performance and the magic of blindness, the things it can do differently? I don't know. Yeah, that's my question. And thank you again both for being on the panel with me.
Oui, allez-y, Dylan.
J'y vais. Quand vous dites blind seer, peut-être mon anglais est mauvais, mais vous parlez bien de l'aveugle voyant, c'est ça?
Oui, oui.
Oui, d'accord.
yeah, the blind seer, the prophet voyant.
oui, oui, oui.
Oui, je l'avais notamment utilisé parce que il y avait chez Jacques Lucéran, mais pas seulement chez Georgina Klig aussi d'une certaine manière, il y avait l'idée d'une commensurabilité, c'est-à-dire d'un partage des expériences entre la vision et la cité qui était telle qu'il y avait une forme de vision de la cécité, ou en tout cas une lumière de la cécité. Et pour ma part, j'ai essayé d'étudier ces thèses déjà en allant contre, parce que mon travail va contre cette hypothèse. Ma phénoménologie est plus une contre-phénoménologie qu'une phénoménologie de la lumière et de la présence. Mais je pense que cette thèse peut être réappropriable. J'ai essayé notamment de le montrer dans mes travaux. Peut être réappropriable, notamment en phénoménologie, parce que la visibilité, la notion de vision, peut ne pas se rapporter à la physiologie même de l'œil. Ni même à l'acte même de percevoir par l'œil. Il peut se rapporter en phénoménologie à la visibilité intrinsèque des choses, c'est-à-dire au fait même que quelque chose est percevable, est possiblement percevable. Et donc, cette visibilité intrinsèque ne renvoie plus du tout à la vision, en fait. Et donc, c'est ça qui est intéressant en phénoménologie, parce que dans la phénoménologie, à la fois, il y a un vocabulaire complètement oculocentré, et en même temps, ce vocabulaire oculocentré ne renvoie parfois plus du tout à la vue. Donc, il y aurait des choses à faire à propos de l'aveugle voyant en phénoménologie, en ramenant cette voyance, cette vision à un champ transcendantal, c'est-à-dire un champ de perception disponible, et non pas nécessairement du coup un champ de perception disponible pour la main, pour le toucher, pour les doigts, pour le goût, pour l'odeur, et non pas nécessairement du coup pour la vue. Donc je pense que oui, il y aurait quelque chose à faire à propos de cette cécité / visibilité, mais tout en sachant que comme le disait David, il y a les mots et ce qu'on en fait. Alors il y a comment on les utilise et comment on est rigoureux à propos de l'analyse qu'on fait d'eux. Voilà comment je répondrai.
Merci beaucoup Dylan. Je crois qu'il est l'heure de nous arrêter pour aujourd'hui. Donc, nous remercions toutes les trois, tous les intervenants et intervenantes du jour, notre conférencière Corinne Doria, les assistantes techniques, les personnes qui ont procédé à la transcription, à la vélotypie artisanale toute la journée, les interprètes grâce auxquels donc ce colloque ne pourrait pas se tenir. Et je vous donne rendez-vous demain à 14h30 pour une petite synthèse des propos du premier jour, où vous pourrez aussi intervenir, faire vos suggestions en vue de ce petit texte que nous envisageons d'écrire présentant les études sur la cécité. Et nous aurons ensuite le grand plaisir d'accueillir notre deuxième conférencière, Georgina Klig, pour sa conférence intitulée « L'art du toucher ». Merci beaucoup à tous et à toutes.